Side 7, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter, continuing on page 267. Save for some reserves, nearly all the forces were in the field now. Apart from a few cavalry skirmishes on the fringe, the battle was concentrating into that tight, bloody mass of carnage at the center of the field, where men lashed at each other relentlessly. Still the fire pits burned, throwing up smoke that obscured the action, and still arrows rained down from the walls of Babylon. Josh could no longer tell which way the advantage of the battle went. It wasn't a time for tactics now, and the opposing generals, perhaps the greatest of all time, could do no more, save like Alexander to swing swords themselves. It was a time to fight or die. Bicesse's medical station was overwhelmed. There was no other word for it. Working alone, she struggled to save a Macedonian sprawled unconscious on the table before her, dumped like a carcass in a butcher's store. He was a boy, no more than 17 or 18 years old, but he had taken a javelin thrust to the stomach. She cleaned, padded, and patched the wound as best she could, her hands trembling with fatigue. But she knew that what would finish the boy off was the infection caused by the garbage that spear point would have carried in with it. And still, all around her, the bodies flowed in. Those selected by the triage teams were no longer carried to the townhouse she had designated as a morgue, but were rudely dumped on the ground, where they were piling up, their dark blood staining the Babylonian dirt. Of those selected for treatment, a handful had been patched up and gone back out to fight, but more than half her patients had died on the treatment tables. "What did you expect, Bicesse?" she asked herself. "You're no doctor. Your only experienced assistant is an ancient Greek who once shook hands with Aristotle himself. You've no supplies. You're running out of everything from clean bandages to boiled water." But she knew she had saved some lives today. It might be futile. The great wave of Mongol aggression might break over the walls and destroy them all. But for now, she found she really and truly didn't want this boy with the punctured stomach to die. She dug into the guiltily hoarded contents of her 21st century medical kit. Trying to hide her actions from the others, she jabbed a shot of streptomycin into the boy's thigh. Then she called for him to be taken away like all the others. "Next." Kolya believed that the Mongols' expansion was pathological. It was a ghastly spiral of positive feedback born of Genghis Khan's unquestioned military genius and fueled by easy conquests, a plague of insanity and destruction that had spread across most of the known world. Russians especially had reasons to despise the memory of Genghis Khan. The Mongols had struck twice. Great cities grown fat on trade, Novgorod, the Azan, and Kiev, were reduced to boneyards. In those dread moments, the heart had been torn out of the country forever. "Not again," Kolya whispered, unable to hear the words himself. "Not again." He knew Casey and the others would resist the Mongol menace as hard as they could. Maybe the Mongols had made too many enemies in the old timeline. Maybe in some transcendent way, they were now facing payback. Of course, his own gamble was still to be played out. Was his weapon powerful enough? Would it even work? But he had confidence in his own technical abilities. Reaching the target, though, was another matter. He had observed Genghis. Unlike Alexander, Genghis was a commander who had watched battles from the safety of the rear and retired to his yurt at the close of the day. Aged nearly 60, he was predictable to that degree. Could Kolya be sure, though, any longer after 3 days, quite what time it was? Could he be sure that the heavy tread he sensed now was indeed the man he sought to destroy? His only real regret was that he would never know. Kolya smiled, thought of his wife, and closed the trigger. He had no eyes, no ears, but he felt the earth lurch. Abdikadir was back to back with a handful of British and Macedonians, fighting off Mongols who swirled around them, most still on horseback, lashing and cutting. His ammunition long exhausted, he had dropped the useless Kalashnikov and fought with bayonet, scimitar, lance, javelin, whatever came to hand. The detritus of dead warriors from ages separated by more than 1,000 years. As the battle had closed around him, at first he had felt as if he had become more alive, as if his life had been reduced to this instant of blood, noise, intense effort and pain, and all that had gone before was a mere prologue. But as fatigue poisons built up, That sense of vividness had been replaced by a coppery unreality, as if he was on the point of fainting. He had trained for this. The drone zone, they called it. A place where the body ignored pain, grew impervious to hot or cold, and a new form of consciousness cut in, a kind of dogged autopilot. But that didn't make it any easier to bear. This little group was surviving where others had already been cut down. An island of resistance in a sea of blood across which the Mongols surged at will. He himself had taken blow after blow, but he knew he couldn't take much more. The battle was being lost, and there was nothing he could do about it. Over the carnage of the battlefield, he heard the cry of a trumpet. An uneven rhythm played on a war drum. He was briefly distracted. A mace swung down from the sky, smashing the scimitar from his hand. Pain lanced. He had broken a finger. Unarmed, one-handed, he turned to face a Mongol cavalryman who reared above him, raising the mace again. Abdikadir lunged, his good hand stretched out stiff as a board, and stabbed at the Mongol's thigh, aiming for a nerve center. The cavalryman stiffened and flopped backward, and his horse stumbled back. Abdikadir got to his knees, found his scimitar in the bloody dirt, and straightened up, panting hard, looking for his next assailant. But there was none. The Mongol cavalrymen were wheeling their horses around, turning back toward their distant encampment. As they galloped away, occasionally one would stop to pick up a dismounted comrade. Abdikadir, standing there panting, clutching his scimitar, simply couldn't take it in. It was as surprising as if a tide had suddenly reversed. He heard a snapping sound close to his ear, almost insectile. He knew what that was, but his mind seemed to grind slowly, dredging up the memory. A sonic boomlet. A bullet. He turned to look. Before the Ishtar Gate, there was one exception to the general withdrawal. Perhaps 50 Mongols, packed tight on their horses, charged at the open gate. And somebody in there, somebody in the middle of the charge, was shooting at him. He dropped the scimitar. The world wheeled, and he found the earth, sodden with blood, reaching up to him. Bisessa heard the screams and roars right outside her casualty point. She rushed out of the door to see what was happening. Ruddy Kipling, the whole front of his shirt sticky with blood, followed her. A pack of Mongol warriors had smashed through the defenders' lines and pushed into the gate. Macedonians were closing around them like antibodies around an infection, and their officers screamed orders. Though the Mongols slashed hard at those around them, already they were being pulled from their horses. When a single figure burst from the struggling pack and ran down Babylon's processional way, it was a woman. The Macedonians hadn't noticed her, or if they had, didn't take her seriously enough to stop her. She was dressed in leather armor, Bisessa saw, but her hair was tied back by a strip of material, bright orange. "Dayglow," Bisessa muttered. Ruddy said, "What did you say?" "That has to be Sable. Shit, she's heading for the temple. The Eye of Marduk. It's what this has been all about. Come on." They ran after Sable down the ceremonial way. Worried-looking Macedonian soldiers rushed past them toward the incursion at the gate, and baffled, terrified Babylonian citizens cowered. Over their heads, eyes hovered like strings of CCTV cameras, impassive. Bisessa was shocked by how many there were. Ruddy was first to the chamber of Marduk. The great eye still hovered over its puddle of congealed gold. Sable stood before the eye, panting, her hair disheveled over her Mongol armor, gazing up at a distorted reflection of herself. She raised a hand to touch the eye. Ruddy Kipling stepped forward. "Madam, get away from there, or..." With a single movement, she turned, raised a pistol, and shot him. In the ancient chamber, the crack of the weapon was loud. Ruddy was hurled backward, slammed against the wall, and slumped to the floor. Bisessa screamed, "Ruddy!" Sable had raised the gun to Bisessa. "Don't try it." Ruddy looked up helplessly at Bisessa, his broad brow dotted with sweat, his thick glasses spattered with the blood of strangers. He clutched his hip. Blood gushed from between his fingers. He grinned foolishly. "I'm shot." Bisessa longed to go to Ruddy, but she stood still and raised her hands. "Sable Jones. My fame spreads. Where's Kolya?" "Dead." "Ah," she smiled. "A thought occurs. A Mongol sounded the retreat. It was me thinking it was a coincidence. But you know what must have happened. Genghis Khan is dead. and his sons and brothers and generals are hurrying back for a Kurultai to decide who gets the big prize. The Mongols have the social structure of a pack of chimpanzees. But just like the chimps, when the alpha male falls, all bets are off. And Kolya used that against them. She shook her head. You have to admire the scrawny little bastard. I wonder how he did it. The gun in her hand never wavered. Ruddy groaned. Assessor tried not to be distracted. What do you want, Sable? What do you think? Sable jerked her thumb over her shoulder. We could hear this thing signal from orbit. Whatever's going on here, this is the key. To past, present, and future. To a new world. Yeah. I think you're right. I've been studying it. Sable's eyes narrowed. In that case, you might be able to help me. What do you say? You're either with me or against me. Misessa looked directly at the eye. She let her eyes open wider and forced a smile. Evidently, it's been expecting you. Sable turned her head. It was a simple trick, but Sable's vanity had trapped her, and Misessa had won a single half-second. It took one kick to shatter Sable's wrist and get the gun out of her hand, another to bring her down. Panting hard, she stood over the fallen cosmonaut. Misessa thought she could smell her, a stink of milk and fat, like the Mongol she had fallen in with. Sable, did you really think the Eye would care about you and your petty ambitions? May you rot in hell. She glared up at the Eye. And you, have you seen enough? Is this what you wanted? Have we suffered enough for you? Misessa. It was a groan, barely formed as a word. Misessa ran to Ruddy. 36. Aftermath. Hephaestion was dead. Alexander had won a great battle in almost impossible circumstances in a new world, against a foe more than 1,000 years more advanced. But in doing so, he had lost his companion, his lover, his only true friend. Alexander knew what was expected of him at this moment. He would retire to his tent and drink himself to oblivion. Or else he would refuse to drink or eat at all for days on end, until his family and companions feared for his health. Or he would order the construction of an impossibly grandiose memorial. Perhaps a carving of a majestic lion, he thought idly. Alexander decided he would do none of those things. He would grieve for Hephaestion in private, true. Perhaps he would order that all the horses in camp should have their manes and tails clipped. Homer told of how Achilles had shorn his horses in honor of his dead, beloved Patroclus. Yes, that was how Alexander might mourn Hephaestion. But for now, there was too much to do. He walked over the blood-soaked ground of the battlefield and through the tents and buildings that housed the wounded. His advisers and companions fluttered anxiously at his heels, and his doctor, for Alexander had taken more than a few more blows himself. Many of the men were glad to see him, of course. Some boasted of what they had done in the battle, and Alexander listened patiently and straight-faced, commended them on their valor. But others were sunk in shock. He had seen this before. They would sit numbly, or they would tell their petty stories over and over. The men would recover, as they always did, as would this bloodied ground, when the spring came and the grass grew again. But nothing could erase the anger and guilt of those who had survived where companions had fallen, as their king would never forget Hephaestion. Ruddy lay back against the wall, arms limp, palms up, fingers curled. His small hands, coated in blood, looked like two crabs, she thought. Blood was gushing from a puncture wound just below his left hip. They're seeing a lot of blood today, Bessessa. He was still smiling. Yeah. She dragged Curlex from her pocket and tried jamming it in the hole, but the blood was still pumping. Sable's shot seemed to have ruptured a femoral artery, one of the primary avenues by which blood reached the lower half of the body. There was no way she could move him, no transfusion she could give him, no Casavac she could call in. No time for sentiment. She had to treat Ruddy as a broken machine, a truck with the bonnet up that she had to fix. She thought desperately. She began to rip open his trouser leg. Try not to talk, she said. Everything will be fine. As Casey would say, bullshit. Casey is a bad influence. Tell me, he whispered. What? What becomes of me? Or would have? No time, Ruddy. Exposed, the wound gaped, a bloody crater from which crimson liquid still flowed. "Here, help me." She got hold of his hands and pushed them against the wound, and she pressed herself, pushing her fingers into the hole up to the knuckle. He squirmed, but he didn't cry out. He seemed terribly pale. His blood was forming a lake beneath him on the floor of the temple, a mirror to the melted gold of the god.
"There's time for nothing else, Possessor. Please."
"You become loved," she said, still working frantically. "The voice of a nation, of an age. You are internationally famous, too. Wealthy. You refuse honors, but they're repeatedly offered to you. You help shape national life. You win a Nobel Prize for Literature. They will say of you that your voice is heard around the world whenever it drops a remark."
"Ah."
He smiled and closed his eyes. She shifted her fingers. Blood spurted out as strongly as ever, and he grunted.
"All those books I will never write."
"But they exist, Rudy. They're in my phone. Every last damn word."
"Yes, that, I suppose. Even if it makes no logical sense if the author doesn't survive to write them. And my family?"
Trying to staunch the flow this way was like trying to stop up a broken pipe by pushing down on it through a pillow. The only thing she could do, she knew, was to find the femoral artery and tie it off directly.
"Rudy, this will hurt like hell."
She dug her fingers into the wound and ripped it wider open. His back arched, his eyes closed.
"My family, please."
His voice was a flutter, dry as autumn leaves. She dug into his leg, picking through layers of fat, muscle, and blood vessel, but she couldn't find the artery. It might have retracted when it was severed.
"I could cut you open," she said. "Search for the damn artery, but the blood loss..."
She couldn't believe how much blood had already poured from the young man. It was all over his legs, her arms, the floor.
"It hurts, you know, but it's cold."
His words were labored. He was going into shock. She pressed down on the wound.
"You have a long marriage," she said quickly. "Happy, I think. Children, a son." "Yes. What is his name?"
John Kipling. "There is a great war that consumes Europe."
"The Germans, I suppose. Always the Germans."
"Yes. John volunteers to fight in France. He dies."
"Ah."
Ruddy's face was almost expressionless now, but his mouth twitched.
"At least he will be spared that pain, as will I. Or perhaps not. That damn logic again. I wish I understood."
He opened his eyes and she saw reflected in them the impassive sphere of the eye of Marduk.
"The light," he said. "The light in the morning."
She pressed a bloody hand to his chest. His heart fluttered and stopped. Refusing help, Alexander clambered stiffly to the top of the Ishtar Gate. He looked out to the east, over the plain, to where the fires of the Mongols still burned. The hovering spheres the men called eyes that had littered the air during the battle had all evaporated now, all save the great monstrosity in the temple of Marduk. Perhaps these new, indifferent gods had seen all they wanted to see. There were tribunals to arrange. It had turned out that the strange Englishman, Cecil de Morgan, had been feeding information to Mongol spies. Information that included the route by which Sable Jones had reached the eye of Marduk so quickly. The English commander Grove and those others, Bisessa and Abdikadir, were demanding the right to try these renegades, De Morgan and Sable, according to their own customs. But Alexander was king, and he knew there was only one justice his men would accept. De Morgan and Sable would be tried before the whole army, drawn up on the plain outside the city. In his own mind, their fate was assured. This war was not done, he thought, even if this mighty figure, Genghis, was dead. He was confident he could destroy the Mongols eventually. But why should Macedonian and Mongol fight at the behest of the gods of the eye, like dogs thrown into a pit? They were men, not beasts. Perhaps there was another way. It amused him that Bisessa and the others called themselves modern, as if Alexander and his time were pale stories from long ago, told by a tired old man. But from Alexander's point of view, these strange, spindly, gaudy creatures from a far and uninteresting future were a froth. There was only a handful of them compared to the great crowds of his Macedonians and of the Mongols. Oh, their gadgets had been briefly useful in the battle against the Khan, but they had soon been exhausted. And then it had been back to the most ancient weapons of all, iron and blood, discipline and raw courage. The moderns didn't matter. It was clear to him that the beating heart of the new world lay here, with him and these Mongols. He had always known that his moment of hesitation at the river Bias had been an aberration. Now it was behind him. He decided he would instruct Eumenes to approach the Mongols once again and seek common ground. If he defeated the Mongols, he would be strong. But if he combined with them, stronger still. There was surely not a power in this wounded world that could match them. And then, armed with the knowledge that Bisessa and the others had brought, there was no limit to the possibilities of the future. Thinking, planning, Alexander tasted the wind that blew from the east, the heart of the world continent, rich and full of time. Part 5. Mir. 37. Laboratory. You could hardly call it a cage. 5 years after the discontinuity and their capture, the man-apes were still trapped under a bit of camouflage net, thrown loosely over a conveniently hovering eye, and weighted down with boulders. Nobody had given any thought to putting together anything better, though some quirk of the military mind had ordered the boulders to be painted white. There was always somebody who needed his attitude adjusted with a bit of pointless work. It was under this net that Seeker spent her days, alone save for the fast-growing Grasper. Grasper was nearly 6 years old now. Her young mind still forming, she had adjusted to the reality of their confinement. Seeker couldn't adjust, but she had to accept it. The soldiers came in once a day to give her food and water and scrape out her dung. Sometimes they held her down and pushed their fat penises into her body. Seeker didn't care about that. She wasn't hurt, and she had learned to let her captors do what they want while she kept an eye on Grasper. She had no idea why the soldiers did what they did, but whether she knew or not didn't matter, of course, for she had no power to stop them. She could break out of here. On some level, she still knew that. She was stronger than any of the soldiers. She could rip open that netting with her teeth and hands or even her feet, but she hadn't seen a single other of her kind save Grasper since the day of her capture. Through the holes in the net, she could see no trees, no welcoming green shade. If she did break out, there was nowhere for her to go. Nothing waiting for her but clubs, fists, and rifle butts. She had had to be taught that brutal lesson. Suspended between animal and human, she had only a dim grasp of future and past. Her memory was like a gallery hung with vivid images. Her mother's face, the warmth of her nest, the overwhelming scent of the male who first took her, the sweet agony of childbearing, the dreadful limpness of her first child. And her sense of the future was dominated by an inchoate vision of her own death, a fear of the blackness that lurked behind the yellow eyes of cats. But there was no sense of narrative about her memories, no logic or order. Like most animals, she lived in the present, where if the present could not be survived, the past and future meant nothing anyhow. And her present, this helpless captivity, had expanded to encompass her whole consciousness. She was a captive. That was all she was. But at least she had Grasper. Then, one morning, something changed. It was Grasper who saw it first. Seeker woke up slowly, as always, clinging to her ragged dreams of the trees. She yawned hugely and stretched her long arms. The sun was already high, and she could see bright glimmers pushing through the gaps in the netting. Grasper was staring up into the tent's apex. There was light on her face. Seeker looked up. The eye was shining. It was like a miniature sun caught in the net. Seeker stood up. Side by side, their gazes fixed on the eye, mother and child walked forward, fully upright. Seeker raised a hand toward the eye. It was out of reach, but it cast shadows of the two of them on their floor of trampled dirt. It gave off no heat, only light. Seeker had only just woken up. She badly needed to urinate, to defecate, to groom, to get rid of the night's ticks, to get some food and water. But she couldn't move. She just stood there, eyes wide, one arm raised. Her eyes began to prickle with dust and cold, but she couldn't so much as blink. She heard a soft whimpering. Seeker couldn't even turn to look at Grasper. She had no idea how much time went by. Her hand was before her face. She hadn't consciously raised it. It was like looking at somebody else's hand. The fingers clenched, opened. The thumb worked back and forth. She was made to raise her arms and twist them at shoulders, elbows, and wrists. She bent and flexed her legs. She walked up and down as far as the netting would let her, first upright, then knuckle-walking. She probed with her fingers at every orifice in her body. She fingered her high rib cage, the shape of her skull, even her pelvis. It was as if somebody else was doing this to her, exploring her in a cruel grooming. The man-apes were released, just for a heartbeat. Panting, hungry, thirsty, they reached for each other. But then the invisible grip closed around them again. This time, as patterns of light pulsed over their heads, Grasper got down on her haunches and began to examine the floor, digging in the dirt. She found twigs, bits of reed. She rubbed the twigs against each other, split and folded the reed, banged pebbles together. Meanwhile, Seeker marched to the netting wall. She took hold of the net and began to climb. Her body proportions were like those of her ape-like ancestors, and she could climb better than any of her human captors. But as she clambered up the net, fear gathered, for she knew she wasn't supposed to do this. Sure enough, one of the soldiers came running. "Here, you! Get down from there!" A rifle butt smashed into her face. She couldn't even scream. Despite the grip of the eye, she fell back from the netting and clattered on her back to the ground. Her mouth full of coppery blood, she tried to raise her head. She could see Grasper sitting on the gritty ground. Grasper held up a reed tied into a knot. Seeker had never seen such a thing. Again she was forced to stand, despite the blood that dripped from her mouth, and stared up at the eye. There was something new again, she realized dimly. The glow of the eye was no longer uniform. A series of brighter horizontal bands straddled an underlying grayness, a pattern that might have reminded a human of lines of latitude on a globe of the Earth. These lines swept up past the eye's equator, dwindling until they vanished at the North Pole. Meanwhile, another set, vertical this time, began the same pattern of emergence, sweeping from a pole on one side of the equator, disappearing on the other side. Now a third set of lines, sweeping to poles set at right angles to the first two pairs, came shining into existence. The shifting, silent display of gray rectangles was entrancing, beautiful. And then a fourth set of lines appeared. Seeker tried to follow where they went, but suddenly something inside her head hurt badly. She cried out. Again those unseen hands released her, and she collapsed to the ground. She rubbed the heels of her palms into her weeping eyes. For the first time, she was aware of a warmth along her inner thighs. She had urinated where she stood and never been aware of it. Grasper was still standing, trembling but upright, gazing up at the washing lights, which cast complex patterns of shadows across her small face. A fifth set of lines, a sixth set, disappearing in impossible directions. Grasper went rigid, her head locked back, her fingers grabbing at nothing, and then she fell, rigid as a block of wood. Seeker grabbed her child and cradled her on her own piss-soaked lap. The stiffness went out of Grasper, and she became a bundle of limp fur. Seeker stroked her and let her suckle, though her flaccid breast had been dry for years. Even now the eye watched them, recording the bond between mother and child, draining the man-apes of every sensation. It was all part of the test. The respite was only brief. Soon the eye resumed its steady, pearly glow, and it was as if unseen hands poked and prodded at Seeker's limbs. She pushed aside her child and stood once more, her face lifted to the unearthly light. 38. The Eye of Marduk. Bisessa moved into the temple of Marduk. She brought in a pallet and blankets and had her food delivered. She even set up a chemical toilet that had come from the bird. She spent most of her time here now alone, save for the small company of the phone and the brooding mass of the eye. She could feel there was something there, a presence behind that impenetrable hide. It was a feeling beyond the immediate senses, like the feeling she would get if she was blindfolded and thrust through a door, and still able to tell if the space she was in was open or confined. But it wasn't like being with a person. Sometimes all she felt was watchfulness, as if the eye was no more than a huge camera. But sometimes she felt she glimpsed something behind the eye. Was there a watcher who stood, metaphorically, behind all the eyes in the world? Sometimes she sensed there was a whole hierarchy of intelligences, in fact, escalating up from the simple constructs of watchers and eyes that she could imagine, up in some impossible direction, filtering and classifying the distillation of her actions, her reactions, her very self. She spent more and more of her time exploring these sensations. She avoided everybody, her 21st century companions, even poor Josh. She would turn to him for comfort, though, when she felt cold and too desolately lonely. But afterward, though she felt genuine affection for him, she would be guilty as if she had used him. She tried not to examine these feelings, tried not even to decide if she loved Josh or not. She had the eye, and that was the center of her world. It had to be. And she wouldn't share herself with anybody or anything else, not even Josh. She tried to apply physics to the eye. She began with simple geometric measurements, like those Abdelkader had tried on the smaller eyes in the northwest frontier. She used laser instruments to prove that for this bauble, too, the famous ratio pi was not about 3 1/7, as Euclid, schoolbook geometry, and the rest of the world demanded, but simply 3. Like all the eyes, this was an intruder from somewhere else. She went beyond geometry. With a party of Macedonians and British, she went back to the northwest frontier and the crash site of the little bird. Months of acid rain hadn't helped to preserve what was left. Still, there was usable electromagnetic sensors working invisible light, infrared and ultraviolet, 21st century spy-in-the-sky electronic eyes, and various chemical sensors, noses, designed to sniff out explosives and the like. She dug out instrumentation, components, cabling, any usable gear, including that small chemical toilet. She set up her equipment in the temple chamber. She improvised scaffolding around the eye and fixed the bird's amputated sensors to gaze at the alien object from all angles, 24 hours a day. In the end, she filled this ancient Babylonian temple chamber with a tangle of cables and infrared comms beams, all leading to an interface box on which her phone patiently sat. She had little electrical power, though, only the batteries from the bird and smaller cells in the gear itself. So her 21st century sensors peered at this impossibly advanced alien artifact by the smoky light of animal fat lamps. She got some answers. The bird's radiation sensors, souped-up Geiger counters designed to sniff out illicit nukes, detected traces of high-frequency X-rays and very high-energy particles emanating from the eye. These results were tantalizing and elusive. And she guessed this was just leakage, that there was a whole spectrum of exotic high-energy radiation products flowing from the eye beyond the capacity of the bird's crude Geigers to pick up. The radiation must be traces of some immense expenditure of energy. The great straining required to keep this eye in existence in an inimical reality, perhaps. And then there was the question of time. She used the bird's altimeter to bounce laser beams off the eye's hide. The laser light was reflected with 100% efficiency. The surface of the eye acted like a perfect mirror. But the beams came back with a measurable Doppler shift. It was as if the surface of the eye was receding fast at more than 100 kilometers per hour. Every point on the surface she tested gave the same result. According to these results, the eye was imploding. To her naked eye, of course, the eye sat fat and immovable, hovering complacently in the air as it always did. Nevertheless, in some direction she couldn't perceive, that slick surface was moving. She suspected that in some sense the eye's existence escalated up in directions beyond her power to see or her instruments to measure. And if that was possible, she mused, perhaps there was only one eye, projecting down from some higher dimension into the world, like fingers from a single hand pushing through the surface of a pond. But sometimes she thought that all this experimentation was just to divert herself from the main issue, which was her intuition about the eye. Maybe I'm just being anthropomorphic, she said to the phone. Why should there be mind, anything like my mind, involved in this at all? David Hume wondered about that, the phone murmured. Dialogues concerning natural religion. Hume asked why we should look for mind as the organizing principle of the universe. He was talking about traditional constructs of God, of course. Maybe the order we perceive just emerges. For aught we know a priori, matter may contain the source or spring of order originating within itself, as well as the mind does. He wrote that down a full century before Darwin proved it was possible for organization to emerge from mindless matter. So you do think I'm anthropomorphizing? No, said the phone. We don't know any way for an object like this to be formed except by intelligent action. Assuming a mind is responsible is probably the simplest hypothesis. And anyhow, perhaps these feelings you have are based in some physical reality, even if they don't come through your senses. Your body, your brain, are complicated instruments in their own right. Perhaps the subtle electrochemistry that underpins your mind is being influenced, somehow, by that. It's not telepathy, but it may be real. Do you sense there's something here? No, but then I'm not human. The phone sighed. Sometimes she suspected the eye was feeding her these insights, deliberately. It's as if it is downloading information into me, bit by bit. But my mind, my brain, is just incapable of taking it all. It's as if I tried to download modern virtual reality software onto a Babbage difference engine. That's a simile I can sympathize with, said the phone dryly. No offense. Sometimes she would simply sit in the ponderous company of the eye and let her mind roam where it would. She kept thinking of Myra. As time passed, as the months turned into years, and the discontinuity, that single extraordinary event, receded into the past, she felt herself embedding more deeply into this new world. Sometimes in this drab antique place, her memories of 21st century Earth seemed absurd, impossibly gaudy, like a false dream. But her feelings of loss about Myra didn't fade. It wasn't even as if Myra had been taken from her somehow to continue her life in some other part of the world. It was no comfort to her to imagine how old Myra would be now, how she must look, where she would be in her school career, what they might have been doing together if they had been reunited. None of those comprehensible human situations applied, because she couldn't know if she and Myra had a timeline in common. It was even possible that there were many copies of Myra on multiple fragmented worlds, some of them even with copies of herself. And how was she supposed to feel about that? The discontinuity had been a superhuman event, and the loss she had suffered was superhuman too, and she had no human way of coping with it. As she lay on her pallet brooding through the night, she sensed the eye watching her, drawing up her baffled grief. She sensed that mind, but there was no compassion there, no pity, nothing but a vast Olympian watchfulness. She would get to her feet and beat on the eye's impassive hide with her fist, or hurl bits of Babylonian rubble at it. Is this what you wanted? Is this why you came here? Why you ripped apart our world and our lives? Did you come here to break my heart? Why won't you just send me home? There was a certain receptivity, she felt. Mostly it felt like the reverberant receptivity of a vast cathedral dome, in which her tiny cries were lost and meaningless. But sometimes she thought someone was listening to her. And just occasionally, compassionless or not, she felt they might respond to her pleas. One day the phone whispered to her, It's time. Time for what? I have to go to safe mode. She had been expecting this. The phone's memory contained a cache of invaluable and irreplaceable data. Not just her observations of the eye and a record of the discontinuity events, but the last of the treasures of the old vanished world, not least the works of poor Rudyard Kipling. But there was nowhere to download the data, not even a way to print it out. During her sleep time, she had given up the phone to a team of British clerks, under the supervision of Abdikadir, who had copied out by hand various documents and diagrams and maps. It was better than nothing, but the phone's capacious memory had barely been scratched. Anyhow, Bessessa and the phone had agreed that when the phone's batteries dropped to a certain critical level, it should make itself inert. It would only take a trickle of power to preserve its data almost indefinitely, until such time as Mir's new civilization advanced enough to access the phone's invaluable memories. And bring you back to life, she had promised the phone. It was all quite logical, and now the moment was here. Vasessa was bereft. After all, this phone had been her companion since she was 12. "You have to press the buttons to shut me down," the phone said. "I know." She held the little instrument before her and found the right key combination through eyes embarrassingly blurred with tears. She paused before hitting the final key. "I'm sorry," said the phone. "It's not your fault." "Vasessa, I'm frightened." "You don't have to be. I'll wall you up if I have to, and leave you to the archaeologists."
"I don't mean that. I've never been switched off before. Do you think I will dream?"
"I don't know," she whispered. She pressed the key, and the phone's surface, glowing green in the gloom of the chamber, turned dark. 39. Explorations. After a 6-month exploratory jaunt into southern India, Abdi Kadir returned to Babylon. Eumenes took him on a tour of the recovering city. It was a cold day. Though it was midsummer, according to the Babylonian astronomers who patiently tracked the motion of stars and sun through a new sky, the wind was chill, and Abdi Kadir wrapped his arms around his body. After months away, Abdi Kadir was impressed with the latest developments. The inhabitants of the city had been hard at work. Alexander had repopulated the depleted city with some of his own officers and veterans, and had installed one of his generals in a joint governorship of the city with one of Babylon's pre-discontinuity officials. The experiment seemed to be working. The new population, a mixture of Macedonian warriors and Babylonian grandees, seemed to be getting along tolerably well. There was much debate about what to do with the region on the western bank, reduced to rubble by time. To the Macedonians, it was a wasteland. To the moderns, it was an archaeological site that could perhaps one day offer up some clues about the great displacement in time that had split this city in two. To leave it alone for now was the obvious compromise. But downstream of the city walls, Alexander's army had dug out a huge natural harbor, deep enough to take ocean-going ships, which were being constructed from local timber and hastily assembled dry docks. There was even a small lighthouse, illuminated by oil lamps with polished shields as mirrors behind them.
"This is magnificent," Abdi Kadir said.
They were standing on the new harbor's wall, which towered over the small vessels that already ventured onto the water beneath it. Eumenes said that Alexander knew that fast transport and effective communications were the key to holding together an empire.
"The king learned that lesson the hard way," Eumenes said dryly.
In 5 years, he had learned some halting English, Abdi Kadir some uncertain Greek. With a little cooperation, they could communicate without interpreters now. Eumenes went on.
"Alexander's progress through Persia owed much to the quality of the imperial roads. When we reached the end of the Persian roads, far to the east, his infantrymen knew they could go no further, no matter what his vaulting ambition desired. And so we had to stop. But the ocean is the road of the gods, and requires no labor to lay it." "Even so, I can't believe you've achieved so much so quickly."
Abdi Kadir, viewing all this industry, felt faintly guilty. Perhaps he had been away too long. He had enjoyed his explorations. In India, Abdi Kadir and his party had hacked a path through dense jungle, encountering all manner of exotic plants and animals, though few people. Similar expeditions were being sent out to east, west, north, south, across Europe, Asia, Africa. To map out this new and rich world seemed to fill a void in Abdi Kadir's heart, left by the loss of his own world, and the trauma of the great killing during the Mongol assault. Perhaps he was exploring the outer world in order to distract himself from the turmoil of the inner, and perhaps he had been evading his true responsibilities too long. He turned away from the city and gazed toward the south, where the glistening tracks of irrigation canals lanced across fields of green. Here was the real work of the world, growing food. This was the fertile crescent, after all, the birthplace of organized agriculture. And once its artificially irrigated fields had provided a third of the food supply for the Persian Empire, there surely couldn't have been a better place to start farming again. But Abdi Kadir had already inspected the fields, and he knew that things weren't going well.
"It is this wretched cold," Eumenes complained. "The astronomers may call this midsummer, but I have known no summer like it. And then there are the locusts and other plagues of insects."
The recovery program was indeed impressive, even if it had been slow starting. The quest to save Babylon from the Mongols was long over, and there seemed no real prospect of a revival of the Mongol threat in the near future. Alexander's ambassadors reported that the Mongols seemed stunned by the sudden emptying of China to their south. 50 million people vanished into thin air. The war with the Mongols had been a great adventure, but it had been a diversion. With the battle won, there had been a deep sense of anticlimax among the British, Macedonians, and Little Bird crew alike. And everyone in Babylon was suddenly left to face the unpleasant truth that this was one campaign from which none of them was ever going home. It had taken some time for them to discover a new purpose, to build a new world. And Alexander, with his energy and indomitable will, had been central to establishing that sense of purpose.
And what is the king working on himself? That, Eumenes pointed grandly to the ceremonial heart of the city.
Abdikadir saw that a broad area had been cleared, and the lower levels of what looked like a new ziggurat had been laid out. He whistled.
That looks like it will rival Babel itself.
Perhaps it will. Nominally, it is a monument for Hephaestion. Its deeper purpose will be to commemorate the world we have lost. These Macedonians always did treasure their funerary arts. And Alexander, I think, has an ambition to rival the massive tombs he once saw in Egypt. But with things as they are in the fields, it is hard for us to afford the manpower for such a venture, no matter how magnificent.
Abdikadir studied the Greek's finely chiseled face.
I have a feeling you're asking me for something.
Eumenes smiled.
And I have a feeling you have a little Greek in you, too. Abdikadir, although the king's wife Roxana delivered a son, a boy who is now 4 years old, so that we have an heir. Alexander's continued well-being over the next few years is essential to us all.
Of course.
But this, Eumenes said, meaning the dockyards and fields, is not enough for him. The king is a complex man, Abdikadir. I should know. He is a Macedonian, of course, and he drinks like one. But he is capable of cold calculation, like a Persian, and he can be a statesman of startling insight. He is like a Greek of the cities. But for all his wisdom, Alexander has the heart of a warrior, and there is a tension between his warmongering instincts and his will to build an empire. I don't think he always understands that himself. He was born to fight men, not locusts in a field or silt in a canal. Let's face it, there are few men to be found out there to fight.
The Greek leaned toward Abdikadir.
The truth is, the running of Babylonia has devolved to a handful of those close to him. There is myself, Perdiccas, and Captain Grove.
Perdiccas was one of Alexander's long-serving officers and among his closest associates. Perdiccas, a commander of the foot companion infantrymen, had been formally given the title Hephaestion had enjoyed before his death, which meant something like vizier.
Eumenes winked. They need my Greek cleverness, you see, but I need Macedonians to work through. Of course, we each have our own followers, especially Perdiccas. There are cliques and conspiracies, as there always have been. But as long as Alexander towers over us, we work together well enough. We all need Alexander. New Babylon needs its king, but
it doesn't need him hanging around here with nothing to do. Soaking up manpower on monuments while there are fields to be tilled.
Abdikadir grinned.
You want me to distract him?
Eumenes said smoothly.
I wouldn't put it like that. But Alexander has expressed curiosity to know if the greater world you describe to us is still there to be had. And I think he wants to visit his father.
His father?
His divine father, Amun, who is also Zeus, at his shrine in the desert.
Abdikadir whistled.
That would be quite a tour.
Eumenes smiled.
All the better. There is the question of Bisessa, too.
I know. She's still locked away with that damn eye.
I'm sure it's invaluable work, but we don't want to lose her to it. You moderns are too few to spare.
Take her with you.
Eumenes smiled.
I hear that Josh is back from Judea. Perhaps he might distract her.
You're a wily devil, Secretary Eumenes.
One does what one must, said Eumenes. Come, I'll show you around the shipyards. The temple chamber was a rat's nest of cables and wires and bits of kit from the crashed chopper. Some of them scarred where they had been crudely cut from the wreck, or even scorched by the fires that had followed the crash. This tangle enclosed the eye, as if Possessor had been seeking to trap it, not study it. But she knew that Abdelkader thought it was she who had become trapped. The discontinuity was a physical event, Possessor said firmly, no matter how mighty the power behind it. Physical, not magical or supernatural. And so it's explicable in terms of physics. But, said Abdelkader, not necessarily our physics. She glanced vaguely about the temple chamber, wishing she still had the phone to help her explain. Abdelkader and a wide-eyed, scared-looking Josh had settled down in a corner of the chamber. She knew Josh hated this place, not just for the awesome presence of the eye, but because it had taken her away from him. Now Josh cracked a flask of hot tea with milk, English style, as Possessor tried to explain her current theories about the eye and the discontinuity. Possessor said, space and time were ruptured during the discontinuity. Ruptured and put back together again. We know that much. And in a way, we can understand it. Space and time are in some senses real. You can bend space-time, for instance, with a strong enough gravity field. It's as stiff as steel, but you can do it. But if space-time is stuff, what's it made of? If you look really closely, or if you subject it to enough bending and folding, well, you can see the grain. Our best idea is that space and time are a kind of tapestry. The fundamental units of the tapestry are strings, minuscule strings. The strings vibrate, and the modes of the vibration, the tones of the strings, are the particles and energy fields we observe, and their properties, such as their masses. There are many ways the strings can vibrate, many notes they can play. But some of them, the highest energy modes, have not been seen since the birth of the universe. All right. Now, the strings need a space to vibrate in. Not our own space-time, which is the music of the strings, but a kind of abstraction, a stratum, in many dimensions. Josh frowned, visibly struggling to keep up. Go on. The way the stratum is set up, its topology, governs the way the strings behave. It's like the sounding board of a violin. It's a beautiful image if you think about it. The topology is a property of the universe on the largest scale, but it determines the behavior of matter on the very smallest scales. But imagine you cut a hole in the sounding board. Make a change to the structure of the underlying stratum. Then you would get a transition in the way the strings vibrate. Abdelkader said, and the effect of such a transition in the world we observe? The strings' vibrations govern the existence of the particles and fields that make up our world and their properties. So if you go through a transition, those properties change. She shrugged. The speed of light might change, for instance. She described her measurements of Doppler shifts in the reflections from the eye of Marduk. Perhaps that was something to do with stratum-level transitions. Josh leaned forward, his small face serious. But, Bessessa, what about causality? You have the Buddhist monk who Kolya described living with his own younger self. Now, what if that old man were to strangle the boy? Would the Lama pop out of existence? And then there is poor Ruddy, dead now, and so forever incapable of writing the novels and poems that you claim, Bessessa, to have stored in your phone? What does your physics of strings and sounding boards say about that? She sighed and rubbed her face. We're talking about a ripped-apart space-time. The rules are different. Josh, do you know what a black hole is? Imagine a star collapsing, becoming so dense that its gravity field deepens hugely. In the end, not even the most powerful rocket could escape from its grasp. In the end, even light itself can't escape. Josh, a black hole is a tear in the orderly tapestry of space-time, and it eats information. If I threw an object into a black hole, a rock or the last copy of the complete works of Shakespeare, it doesn't matter. Almost all the information about it is lost, beyond retrieval, nothing but its mass, charge and spin. Now, the interfaces between the chunks of mirror, drawn from different eras, were surely not like the event horizons of black holes, but they were space-time rips. And perhaps information is lost in the same way. And that's why causality has broken down. I think our new reality here on Mir is knitting up. New causal chains are forming. But the new chains are part of this world, this reality, and have nothing to do with the old. She rubbed tired eyes. That's the best I can do. Depressing, isn't it? Our most advanced physics offers us nothing but metaphors. Abdi Kadir said gently, "You must write this down. Have Eumenes assign you a secretary to record it all." "In Greek?" Bisessa laughed hollowly. Joss said, "We are talking of the how of the discontinuity. I am no closer to understanding the why." "Oh, there was a purpose," said Bisessa. She glared up at the eye resentfully. "We just haven't figured it out yet. But they are up there somewhere, beyond the eye, beyond all the eyes, watching us. Playing with us, maybe." "Playing?" She said, "Have you seen the way the eye in the cage has been experimenting with the man-apes? They run around that damn net like rats with wires in their heads." Josh said, "Perhaps the eye is trying to..." He spread his hands. "Stimulate the man-apes. Uplift them to greater intelligence." "Look in their eyes," said Bisessa coldly. "This has nothing to do with uplift. They are draining those wretched creatures. The eyes aren't here to give. They are here to take." "We are no man-apes," said Abdi Kadir. "No, but maybe the tests they are running on us are just more subtle. Maybe the peculiar features of the eye, like its non-Euclidean geometry, are there solely as a puzzle box for us. And you think it was a coincidence that Alexander and Genghis Khan were both brought here? The two greatest warlords in Eurasian history, knocking their heads together by chance? They are laughing at us. Maybe that's all there is to this whole damn thing." "Bisessa," Josh took her hands in his, "you believe the eye is the key to everything that is happening." "Well, so do I. But you are letting the work destroy you. And what good will that do?" She looked at him and Abdi Kadir, alarmed. "What are you two cooking up?" Abdi Kadir told her about Alexander's planned European expedition. "Come away with us, Bisessa. What an adventure!" "But the eye will still be here when you get back," Josh said. "We can delegate somebody else to continue your monitoring." Abdi Kadir said, "The man-apes can't leave their cage. You are a human. Show this thing it can't control you, Bisessa. Walk out." "Bullshit," she said tiredly. Then she added, "Casey."
"What?"
"Casey's got to run this shop. Not some Macedonian, and not some British, who would be worse, because he'd think he understands."
Abdi Kadir and Josh exchanged a glance.
"As long as I don't tell him he's got to do it," said Josh quickly.
Bisessa glared up at the eye.
"I'll be back, you bastards, and be nice to Casey. Remember, I know more about you than I've told them yet."
Abdi Kadir frowned.
"Bisessa, what do you mean by that?"
"That I might know a way home. But she couldn't tell them that, not yet." She stood up.
"When do we leave?"
40. The Boating Lake. The journey would begin at Alexandria. They were to sail counterclockwise around the complicated shore of the Mediterranean. Starting from Egypt, they would travel north and then west along the southern coast of Europe, all the way to the Straits of Gibraltar, and back along the northern coast of Africa. Nothing this king did was modest. He was, after all, Alexander the Great. And his jaunt around the Mediterranean, which his advisers had wryly taken to calling Alexander's Boating Lake, was no exception. Alexander had been terribly disappointed to find that the city he had planted at the mouth of the Nile, his Alexandria on the Nile, had been obliterated by the discontinuity. But undeterred, he ordered units of his army to begin the construction of a new city there on the plan of the vanished old. And he set his engineers the task of building a new canal between the Gulf of Suez and the Nile. In the meantime, he ordered the hasty construction of a temporary harbor at Alexandria, and had many of the ships he had constructed in India sailed up the Gulf of Suez, broken down into sections, and hauled overland. To Bessessa's amazement, it took only a couple of months before the fleet was reassembled at the site of Alexandria and ready to sail. After a two-day festival of sacrifices and merriment in the tent compound that housed the city's workers, the fleet set off. At first, Bessessa, separated from the eye of Marduk for the first time in 5 years, found the voyage strangely relaxing. She spent a lot of time on deck, watching the land unravel past her, or listening to complicated cross-cultural discussions. Even the ocean was a curiosity. In her time, the Mediterranean, recovering from decades of pollution, had become a mixture of game reserve and park, fenced off with great invisible barriers of electricity and sound. Now it was wild again, and she glimpsed dolphins and whales. Once she thought she saw the torpedo shape of an immense shark, bigger than anything from her day, she was sure. It was never warm, though. Often in the morning, she would smell frost in the air. Every year it seemed a little colder, though it was hard to be sure. She wished they had thought to keep climate records from the beginning. But despite the chill, she found she had to keep out of the sun. The British took to wearing knotted handkerchiefs on their heads, and even the nutmeg-brown Macedonians seemed to burn. On the royal boats, thick awnings were erected, and Alexander's doctors experimented with ointments of ass's butter and palm sap to block the suddenly intense rays of the sun. The storms of the early days after the discontinuity had long passed, but clearly the climate remained screwed up. At night, there was more strangeness, too. Under the tented canopies, Alexander and his companions drank the night away. But Bessessa would sit in the darkened quiet of the deck, watching land go by on which there was generally not a single light to be seen. She would peer up, if the sky was clear, at subtly altered constellations. But often she would see auroras, great walls and sheets and curtains of light, visibly three-dimensional structures towering over the darkened world. She had never known of auroras visible at such low latitudes, and she had an uneasy feeling about what they might portend. The discontinuity wasn't cosmetic, and might have cut deep indeed into the fabric of the world. Sometimes Josh would sit with her, and sometimes, if the Macedonians were quiet, they would find a dark corner and make love, or perhaps just huddle together. But most of the time she kept to herself. She suspected her friends were right, that she had been in danger of losing herself in the eye. She needed to ground herself in the world once more, and even Josh was a distraction. But she knew she was hurting him once again. The ostensible point of the trip was to survey the new world, and every few days Alexander sent parties inland. He had selected a small force of Iranians, colonial Greeks, and agrarians to carry out these missions. Highly mobile, flexible troops, brimming with initiative and daring. Some British were attached to each party, and each foray was accompanied by surveyors and map-makers. The first reports were desolating, though. From the beginning, the explorers reported wonders. Strange rock formations, islands of extraordinary vegetation, even more extraordinary animals. But these marvels were all aspects of the natural world. Of the works of mankind, barely a trace survived. The ancient civilization of Egypt, for example, had vanished completely. The great blocks of its monumental buildings were uncut from their sandstone beds. And in the Valley of the Kings, there was no sign of anything like humanity save a few of the cautious, chimp-like creatures the British called man-apes, clinging to patches of forest. It was a relief to sail up the coast of Judea. Of Nazareth and Bethlehem, there wasn't a trace, and no sign of Christ or his passion. But close to the site of Jerusalem, under the command of British engineers, a small industrial revolution was being kick-started. Josh and Bessessa toured foundries and yards where cheerful British engineers and sweating Macedonian laborers and a few bright Greek apprentices constructed pressure vessels like giant kettles and experimented with prototype steamship screws and lengths of railway track. The engineers were learning to communicate in an archaic Greek studded with English words like crankshaft and head of steam. As everywhere, there was a rush to build quickly before the memories and capabilities of the first generation transmitted across the discontinuity were lost. But Alexander himself, a lead from the front warrior king, had turned out to be something of a skeptic when it came to technology. It had taken the construction of a prototype to impress him. This had been something like the famous Aeolipile of Hero, in a lost timeline, a manufacturer of mechanical novelties in Alexandria, just a pressure vessel with two canted nozzles that would vent steam and spin around like a lawn sprinkler. But Eumenes had immediately seen the potential of this new form of power. It was a difficult job, though. The British had only a handful of the necessary tools, and the industry's infrastructure would have to be built literally from the ground up, including establishing mines for coal and iron ore. The Cessa thought it might be 20 years before it was possible to manufacture engines as efficient and powerful as James Watt's, say. "But it begins again," Aptikadir said. "Soon, all across Alexander's domain, there will be pumps laboring in mines dug deeper and deeper, and steamships cruising a shrinking Mediterranean, and great rail networks spreading east across Asia toward the capital of the Mongols. This new Jerusalem will be the workshop of the world." "Ruddy would have loved it," Josh said. "He was always very impressed with machines. Like a new breed of being in the world," he said. And Ruddy said that transport is civilization. If the continents can be united by steamships and railway trains, perhaps this new world need see no more war. No more nations, indeed, save the single marvelous nation of mankind. Abdikadir said, "I thought," he said, "sewage was the basis of civilization." "That, too." The Cessa fondly took Josh's hand. "Your optimism is like a caffeine hit, Josh." He frowned. "I'll take that as a compliment." Abdikadir said, "But the new world is going to be nothing like ours. There are overwhelmingly more of them, the Macedonians, than us. If a new world state does come into existence, it will be speaking Greek, if not Mongol, and it's likely to be Buddhist." In a world stripped of its messiahs, the strange time-twin Buddhists in their temple deep in Asia have been gathering interest from both Macedonians and Mongols. The Lama's circular life seemed a perfect metaphor for both the discontinuity and the strange condition of the world it had left behind, as well as for the religion the Lama gently espoused. "Oh," said Josh wistfully, "I wish I could spring forward through two or three centuries and see what grows from the seeds we are planting today." But as the journey continued, such dreams of building empires and taming worlds came to seem petty indeed. Greece was empty. No matter how hard Alexander's explorers probed the dense tangle of forest that coated much of the mainland, there were no signs of the great cities. No Athens, no Sparta, no Thebes. There were barely signs of humans at all. A few rough-looking tribesmen, said the explorers, and what they described as sub-men. More in hope than anticipation, Alexander sent a party north to Macedon to see what might have survived of his homeland. It took weeks for the scouts to return with negative news. "It seems," Alexander said with a dry wistfulness, "there are more lions in Greece now than philosophers." But even the lions weren't doing too well, the Cessa noted sadly. Everywhere they traveled, they saw signs of ecological damage and collapse. The Greek forests were wilted and fringed by scrubby grassland. In Turkey, the inland areas had been baked clean of life altogether, leaving the ground an exposed rust brown. "Red as Mars," Abdikadir said after taking part in one jaunt. And as they explored the island that had once been called Crete, Josh asked, "Have you noticed how few birds there are?" It was hard to be sure about the extent of what was being lost, as there was no way of knowing what had crossed through the discontinuity in the first place. But Bessessa suspected there was a major dieback underway. They can only guess at the causes. "Just mixing everything up must have done a great deal of damage," Bessessa said. Josh protested. "Mammoths in Paris, saber-toothed cats in the Colosseum of Rome. Near is a bringing together of fragments, but so is a kaleidoscope, and its effect is beautiful." "Yeah, but whenever you get mixing of populations, you get extinctions. When the land bridge between North and South America was joined, when humans carried rats and goats and such around the world to devastate native wildlife, so it must be here. You have creatures from the depth of the Ice Age, side by side with rodents from modern cities, and a climate suited to neither. Whatever survived the discontinuity is wiping out its neighbor, or being wiped out in turn.
Just like us, Abdelkader said blackly. We couldn't stand being mixed up either, could we?
Assessor said there must be booms and crashes. Maybe that explains our plagues of insects, a symptom of an out-of-kilter ecology. Diseases must be transmitted across the old boundaries, too. I'm a little surprised that we've had no real epidemics.
Abdelkader said we humans are too thinly scattered. Even so, perhaps we've been lucky.
But no birds trill from the trees, Josh complained.
Birds are bellwethers, Josh, Assessor said. Birds are vulnerable. Their habitats, like wetlands and beaches, are easily damaged in climate shifts.
The loss of the birds is a bad sign.
Then if things are so difficult for the animals, Josh pounded his bunched fist onto a rail.
We must do something about it.
Abdelkader laughed, then stopped himself.
What exactly?
You mock me, said Josh, red-faced. He waved his hands, grasping at ideas.
We should gather the animals in zoos or reserves. The same with the vegetation, the trees and plants. The birds and insects, too, especially the birds.
And then when things settle down, we can release the beasts into the wild.
And let a new Eden build itself, Assessor said.
Dear Josh, we're not mocking you.
And we should put your idea of gathering zoo specimens to Alexander. If the mammoth and the cave bear have been brought back to life, let's keep a few. But it's just that we've learned it's more complicated than that.
Learn the hard way. Conserving ecospheres, let alone repairing them, isn't so easy. Especially as we never understood how they worked anyhow.
They aren't even static. They are dynamic, undergoing great cycles.
Extinctions are inevitable. They happen at the best of times. No matter what we try, we can't keep it all.
Josh said, then what are we to do? Simply throw up our hands and accept whatever fate has decreed?
No, said Bessessa. But we have to accept our limits.
There are only a handful of us. We can't save the world, Josh. We don't even know how to. We will do well to save ourselves. We must be patient.
Abdelkader said grimly, patience, yes. But it took only a fraction of a second for the great wounds of the discontinuity to be inflicted. It will take millions of years for them to heal.
And it had nothing to do with fate, Josh said. If the gods of the eye were wise enough to rip apart space and time, could they not have foreseen what would become of our ecologies?
They fell silent, and the jungles of Greece, dense, wilting, menacing, slid by. 41. Zeus, Ammon. Italy seemed as deserted as Greece. They found no sign of the city-states the Macedonians remembered, or the modern cities of Bessessa's time. Even at the mouth of the Tiber, there was no trace of the extensive harbor workings that the imperial Romans had constructed to service the great grain fleets that had kept their bloated city alive. Alexander was intrigued by accounts of how Rome, just an ambitious city-state in his day, would one day have built an empire to rival his own. So he put together a handful of riverboats, and reclining under a brilliant purple canopy, led a party up the river. The seven hills of Rome were immediately recognizable, but the site was uninhabited, save for a few ugly hill forts sitting squat on the Palatine, where the palaces of the Caesars would have been built. Alexander thought this was a great joke, and decided graciously to spare the lives of his historical rivals. They spent a night camped close in the marshy lowland that should have become the Forum of Rome. There was another startling aurora which brought gasps from the Macedonians. Bessessa was no geologist, but she wondered what must have happened deep in the core of the world when the new planet had been assembled from its disparate fragments. Earth's core had been a spinning worldlet of iron as big as the moon. If the stitching together of Mir went to the very center of the world, that great sub-planet, crudely reassembled, must be thrashing and roiling. The currents in the outer layers, the mantle, would be disturbed too, with plumes of molten rock, fountains hundreds of kilometers tall, breaking and crashing against each other. Maybe the effects of such deep storms were now being felt on the surface of the planet. The planet's magnetic field, generated by the great iron dynamo of the spinning core, must have collapsed. Maybe that explained the auroras, and the continuing failure of their compasses. In normal times, this magnetic shield protected fragile life forms from a hard rain from space.
heavy particles from the sun, sleeting remnants from supernova explosions. Before the magnetic field restored itself, there would be radiation damage, cancers, a flood of mutations, almost all of them harmful. And if the battered ozone layer had collapsed too, the flood of ultraviolet would explain the intensified sunlight and would do even more damage to the living creatures exposed on Earth's surface. But there were other domains of life. She thought of the deep, hot biosphere, the ancient, heat-loving creatures that had survived from Earth's earliest days, lingering around ocean vents and deep in the rocks. They wouldn't be troubled by a little surface ultraviolet. But if the world had been sliced to its core, their ancient empire must have been partitioned, just as on the surface. Was there some slow extinction event unfolding deep in the rocks, as on the surface? And were their eyes buried in the body of the world to watch that, too? The fleet sailed on, tracking the southern coast of France, and then along eastern and southern Spain, making toward Gibraltar. There were few signs of humans, but in the rocky landscape of southern Spain, the scouts found a stocky kind of people with beetling brows and great strength, who would flee at the first sight of the Macedonians. Bisessa knew this area had been one of the last holdouts of the Neanderthals as Homo sapiens had advanced west through Europe. If these were late Neanderthals, they were well advised to be wary of modern humans. Alexander was much more intrigued by the straits themselves, which he called the Pillars of Heracles. The ocean beyond these gates was not quite unknown to Alexander's generation. 2 centuries before Alexander, the Carthaginian Hanno had sailed boldly south along the Atlantic coast of Africa. There were less well-documented reports, too, of explorers who had turned to the north and found strange, chill lands where ice formed in the summer and the sun would not set even at midnight. Alexander now seized on his new understanding of the shape of the world. Such strangeness was easy to explain if you believed you were sailing over the surface of a sphere. Alexander longed to brave the wider ocean beyond the straits. Josh was all for this, eager to get in touch with the community at Chicago that might not be far removed from his own time. But Alexander himself was more interested in reaching the new mid-Atlantic island the Soyuz had reported. He had been stirred by Bisessa's descriptions of voyages to the moon, and he said that to conquer a land was one thing, but to be the first ever to set foot there, quite another. But even a king had constraints. For one thing, his small ships weren't capable of surviving at sea for more than a few days without putting into shore. The quiet words of his counselors persuaded him that the new world of the West would wait for other days. So, with reluctance mixed with anticipation, Alexander agreed to turn back. The fleet sailed back along the Mediterranean's southern shore, the coast of Africa. The journey was unremarkable, the coast apparently uninhabited. Bisessa withdrew into herself once more. Her weeks on Alexander's expedition had taken her away from the vivid intensity of her time with the eye itself, and had given her time to reflect on what she had learned. Now, something of the blankness of both sea and land made the mysteries of the eye revive in her mind. Abdikadir and especially Josh tried to draw her out of herself. One night as they sat on the deck, Josh whispered, "I still don't understand how you know. When I look up at the eye, I feel nothing. I am prepared to believe that each of us has an inner sense of others, that minds, lonely bits of spindrift in the great dark ocean of time, have a way of seeking each other out. To me, the eye is a vast and ponderous mystery, and clearly a center of awesome power. But it is the power of a machine, not a mind." Bisessa said, "It is not a mind, but it is a conduit to minds. They're like shadows at the end of a darkened corridor, but they are there." There were no human words for such perceptions, for she suspected no human being had experienced such things before. "You have to trust me, Josh." He wrapped his arms tighter around her. "I trust you and I believe you. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. You know, sometimes I think all these time slices we visit are just bits of a fantasy, fragments of a dream." Abdikadir frowned, his blue eyes bright in the light of the lamps. "What do you mean by that?" She struggled to explain her impressions. "I think in some sense they're contained in the eye." She retreated to the safety of physics. Think of it this way. The fundamental units of our reality, the tiny strings, Josh said.
That's right. They aren't really like strings on a violin. There are different ways they can be wrapped around their underlying stratum, their sounding board. Imagine loops of string floating free in the board's surface, and others wrapped right around the board. If you change the dimensions of the stratum, if you make it thicker, the winding energy of the wrapped strings will increase, but the vibrational energy of the loops will decrease, and that will have an effect on the observable universe. If you keep that up long enough, the two dimensions, long and short, exchange places. They have an inverse relationship.
Josh shook his head. You've lost me.
I think she's telling us, Abdikadir said, that in this model of physics, very large distances and very small are somehow equivalent.
Yes, she said, that's it.
The cosmos and the subatom. One is just an inverse of the other, if you look at them the right way. And the eye contains an image of me, she said, just as my retina has on it a projected image of you, Josh. But I think in the case of the eye, the reality of the image of me and of the world is more than a mere projection.
Abdikadir frowned.
Then the distorted images in the eye are not just a shadow of our reality. And by manipulating these images, the eye is somehow able to control what goes on in the outside world. Perhaps that is how it managed to induce the discontinuity. Is that what you think?
Like voodoo dolls, Josh said, enraptured by the notion.
The eye contains a voodoo world. But Abdikadir isn't quite right, is he, Bassetta? The eye doesn't do anything. You have said that the eye, marvelous as it is only a tool, and that you have sensed presences beyond the eye which control it. So the eye is not some demonic controlling entity. It is merely a control panel, she whispered. I always knew you were smart, Josh.
Ah, said Abdikadir slowly.
I start to understand. You believe that you have some access to this control panel, that you can influence the eye. And that is what scares you.
She couldn't meet his bright eyes. Josh said, bewildered, but if you can influence the eye,
what have you asked it to do?
She hid her face.
To let me go home, she whispered. And I think...
What?
I think it might.
The others fell silent, shocked. But she had said it at last, and she knew now that as soon as this jaunt was over, she must confront the eye once more, challenge it again, or die trying. Some days short of Alexandria, the fleet put to shore. This, Alexander's surveyors assured him, was the site of Paraetonium, a city he had once visited, although there was no trace of it now. Eumenes met them here. He said he wished to accompany his king as he retraced the most significant pilgrimage of his life. Alexander sent out scouts to round up camels, which were laden with water for 5 days' journey. A small party of no more than a dozen, including Alexander, Eumenes, Josh, and Bassetta, with a few close bodyguards, quickly formed up. The Macedonians wrapped themselves up in long Bedouin-style winding clothes. They had been here before and knew what to expect. The moderns followed their lead. They set off south, inland from the sea. The journey would last several days. Tracing the border of Egypt and Libya, they followed a chain of eroded hills. As her stiffness wore off and her muscles and lungs began to respond to the exercise, Bassetta found herself losing her thoughts in the simple physical repetition of the walk. More therapy, she thought dryly. Overnight they slept in tents and their Bedouin wraps. But on the second day they were hit by a sandstorm, a hot blizzard of coarse grit. After that they ventured through a ravine oddly carpeted by seashells, and through landscapes of wind-sculpted rock, and across a grueling gravel plateau. At last they reached a small oasis. There were palm trees and even some birds, quail and falcon, preserved in a desolate landscape of salt flats. The place was dominated by a gaunt, ruined citadel, and small shrines stood coyly half-hidden by vegetation among the springs. There were no people here, no sign of habitation, nothing but picturesque ruin.